There's shock and horror across the Tasman at the most printed typo in history, very probably. No one noticed it for nearly 2 years because you had to squint to see it. It was the word responsibility without the third I. So responsibility misspelled three times on the new Australian $50 note and a stirring quote from pioneering parliamentarian Edith Cowan. The quote should read, "It is a great responsibility, not responsibility, to be the only woman here." There are 480 million of the $50 notes in circulation, and the printing firm has taken responsibility for it. The Reserve Bank of Australia Governor Philip Lowe says he's relatively relaxed about it. I'm not sure if our next guest will be. Alan Jovan runs the Grammar Table website, but she also sits at the Grammar Table itself in New York City. She's a writer, teacher, language lover. She runs Syntaxis, a communication skills training firm, and she has relevant degrees from UCLA and Harvard. Last year, Ellen picked up a folding table in her Upper West Side apartment, carried it outside, and stuck a grammar sign on it. She was hoping that people would come by to ask questions and chat about language, and that's just what happened. Ellen Jovan, hello.
Hello, Jim. Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you. So how long did it take for the talk to start when you bunged your table on the street that day for the first language conversation to begin? How soon do people take an interest?
About 30 seconds.
Wow.
Yeah, and I put the sign on there, and it was just a little problematic because, you know, the sign's kind of big, so it catches wind like a sail. So I had to manage the whole thing. But literally, I propped it up there, and a couple saw it instantly. They disappeared around the corner, and then half the couple came back to ask some questions.
Do you remember what the first questions were that you were ever asked?
Unfortunately, I remember only what the second question was, which makes me sad. Maybe I'll be able to retrieve it from my notes one day, but do you want to know what that question was?
Yes.
How many words do you think Donald Trump has in his vocabulary?
I think he probably has an awful lot, a fantastic amount, a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful number of words that he can use.
Right. That's exactly how I answered. I made my sign myself on my iPad. And one of the things that I put in a corner of the sign just to make sure people knew that that was available as part of the grammar service, I put the best words.
How do you mean the best words?
Well, Donald Trump claimed to have the best words.
Yes.
So I decided that that needed to be on my sign.
I was trying to summon up typical Trump hyperboles, but they deserted me. So the best the best words is great. What made you pick up that folding table and walk outside in the first place?
The whole idea was probably developing in my subconscious for years because it was so spontaneous when I did it. The only thing that kept me from doing it 4 weeks earlier is that it's too hot in the summer here. I don't like the heat, so I waited until it cooled down a little bit. I like talking to people, and I'm the kind of person who talks to people in the elevators, on the subway, so I don't know, maybe you have people listening who hate people like that, but I try to do it in a non-annoying way. And I love talking about language, so I fused my interest in talking with my interest in talking about language, and that's what happened.
It's a great thing to have done. What do people, Ellen, ask you most about and talk to you most about?
There's no competition for the most popular question. It's asked so much more often than the second most asked question that I don't even know what the second most asked question is. So the first most the most popular question is about the Oxford comma.
Oh, really?
Do you use that term there for the comma? That's the comma that goes before the and in a list of items. So if I say,
I went to Seattle, San Francisco, Detroit, and New York City.
Yes, that's a really nice list you just came up with.
We do have that discussion in New Zealand about the Oxford comma, but not nearly as much as in America, I know, where I saw it once as an issue in the New York Times. So do people ask about that a lot, do they?
They really do. They ask about it all the time. And a funny thing about that also, I teach writing classes and for adults. And twice in my classes in the past month, women have complained about men who refer to their Oxford comma preferences in their online dating profiles.
No.
Yes, it's popular enough that people start to notice it as a thing, and it's now starting to irritate people. I guess it's supposed to signify erudition, or it's just people. It's like a in joke. And someone pointed out to me yesterday that there was actually an article in GQ back in February about the use of the Oxford comma in online dating. So, this extends into all areas of life. It's not just about, writing for work. It's also about your entire romantic existence.
I can see. So, what is your position on the Oxford comma?
My position is I don't care because I really don't think it's very important. I think it just depends on when I was working as a, I worked as a freelance reporter for a while, years ago, and I wouldn't include it because they didn't want to include it. That wasn't the style for the publications I was writing for. And then I did more corporate work, and then I started putting it back in because some of my clients liked it. So I just really, I'm very flexible about these things. And I think that can be a little bit annoying to people because they want an absolute answer, but language is messy. And that's one of the things that I enjoy so much about it, and what there's so much play.
I've done a little bit of reading about you, and two little boys aged 4 and 5 approach you one day. What did they want to know? Do you remember?
Of course, I'm never going to forget that until the day I die. I'm going to remember that because it was so weird. That was in the early days of Grammar Table, meaning last fall, this happened. I was just sitting there innocently minding my business at Grammar Table, and these two little boys came up to me, and the older one said to me, "What's a gerund?" And this is not a normal event for me. And I know for a fact that 5-year-olds don't think about gerunds. It's just not something that happens. So I did not see the adult who had sent them over. Clearly there was one, but I couldn't see him or her. I think I said something like, "Well, it's an ing verb form used as a noun." And then I'm thinking, 4 and 5-year-olds don't know anything about what I just said. They don't know verbs. They don't know nouns. They just talk. They're not thinking about that. So then I just decided to switch to just, talking to them as kids. And I asked if they were related. And then one said yes. One said yes, and one said no. And that was a little confusing, but then the older one explained that the little one didn't know what that meant, and he said we're brothers. And then he put his hands around the little boy's neck. This actually really happened right in front of me at Grammar Table. So the big one put his hands around the little one's neck and started choking him in front of me. And then I said, "No choking your brother at the, or no choking of your brother, maybe. I can't remember whether I had the preposition, but no choking your brother at the grammar table." And then I saw this guy fly from across the park. I was in a small park at the time, towards the kids. And as he got there to rescue the little one from the big one, I realized that I had an opportunity, and I said, "That was a gerund."
Choking.
Yes. I feel good about that one.
You
It
should be.
dramatized. See, it dramatized the grammar. That makes it more memorable.
Yeah, big drama. I've got the question, the hard question right at the get-go here that everyone wants to know. When do you use semicolons?
Well, there are two main areas that they come up. The most important one by far, and I think the one that's really the only one that's really relevant to a lot of people, is between two independent clauses. And if that is an unfamiliar term, I mean between two things that could be complete sentences. So where you could put a period, but you want to bring the ideas more closely together. They also show up in this in another application in really complicated lists of things. We had the list of cities that you provided before, but in very like what if you had a list where you include the city and the state?
Oh,
So
yeah.
if you said Sedona, Arizona, Chicago, Illinois, and then two other cities, and so you had commas in each of the items already, then you could put a semicolon after each state. What I see often is that people will use the semicolon after what could be a standalone sentence, but the part after the semicolon is not a standalone.
I get you. Yeah.
So,
So like a
yeah,
comma.
so that that's
Yeah.
a really, yeah, exactly.
Okay. I know something else you were asked, and again, this may have been in the New York Times, I don't know. The use of the preposition of along with an apostrophe S when asserting possession. For example, Kim Jong-un is a lovely, lovely man and a close friend of Donald Trump's. Correct or not?
Yeah. Oh, right. So the double possessive. I'm laughing at your example. So a painting of Jim means something different than a painting of Jim's, right? A painting of Jim's is your painting. A painting of Jim is a painting that depicts you. And so it's actually a very common thing. People use it a lot in English, but it's just when they start to pay too much attention that they get messed up.
Who gets the most use out of the grammar table? What gives you the most pleasure from being there?
I'm expecting to be able to answer that question differently in a few months because I'm going to be driving all over the United States
Gee.
with Grammar Table and talking to people in different parts of the country who have some regional dialect differences and may have different concerns than outside my front door. But I think that there's a quality to the experience for me that I didn't expect that is maybe even more important than the minutiae of the grammar, which is just the human bonding experience over something that's very fundamental to how we connect as human beings and how our society is held together, this thing that we have in common language. So the table says grammar table, but people come up and they want to know how to pronounce things, they want to know how to spell things, they want to know, they have writing questions, they have presentation questions, almost anything that relates to how we use words in our daily lives, which is a very broad spectrum. It's fun to think about these words that dance through our lives.
Dancing through our lives, that's a nice way of putting it. You get asked about less versus fewer dancing through our lives, and less versus fewer seems easy, but it does seem also to baffle people, doesn't
That may be the second most common question. You may have reminded me of the second most common
it?
question. I am asked about that a lot, and I am not as absolutely rigid about it as some of the people who come by the table. One thing that confuses people, I think, so usually you use fewer with things that are countable, like books. Books are countable, one book, two book, three books. So you would say, I have fewer books than you do, that kind of thing. And you would say less with something like cheese. I have less cheese than you do. This has not come up for me a lot, but that's what you would do. But then what do you do if you're talking about what if you want to run 6 miles, but you didn't run 6 miles, you ran less than 6 miles or fewer than 6 miles? I think when people start to overthink these things, they start to confuse themselves and often choose something that's not very natural
Yeah, that's a
as
good
a,
point. Fewer
because it's
than
so I can count miles, but it's a, you're considering it as a heap.
Yeah.
It's like a bunch. So it's just less than 6 miles.
Yeah, that's a good example. Fewer than 5% of companies have female chief executives. You don't like the use of fewer there, I think.
Not really. So a more straightforward example might be, what if you're talking about a group, 400 people, so you say 1% of the attendees have or has a complaint about whatever. To me, it's unnatural. So the 1% is describing a portion of a countable group, and you're not really thinking about the 1% as much as you are about the collection of people within the 400. Does that make sense? So one thing that interests me a lot is where math and grammar intersect. And if you wouldn't mind, I would like to bring up something that I noticed from one of your previous shows, which is the headline was something like, one in three New Zealanders will, was it about changing? It was about, oh, plan to change jobs in the next year. One in three New Zealanders plan to change jobs in the next year. So a lot of people who come up to Grammar Table would say, if they saw that headline, they would say, oh, it's one. It says one in three, so it should be plans. And
Yes.
I don't agree with that. I agree with what you have on your program listing.
Isn't it funny? Because I'm so pedantic, I would have put one in three New Zealanders' plans, and but I'm a bit old school. Okay, and I.
No, but it's like a portion, it's like a fraction, it's like a percentage. So it's really not one person. It's the idea really represents a lot more. So you're unhappy with your website, but I'm really happy with it. And I think that's what's important here.
Speaking of happy, there are, I think, some heartwarming moments for you when, for example, immigrants come to you wanting to know important things about language and you can provide the answers.
Yes, I've had people come up to me and ask how they can, non-native speakers of English, how they can improve their language skills. A woman came up to me once. This touched me a lot, and she just began speaking to me in Spanish. She didn't even ask me if I spoke Spanish. She just began speaking to me in Spanish and wanted to know how she could learn English. And I don't know, the feeling that I get from something like that, it's actually very emotional to me because I feel so terrible about the kind of English only movement and, the encounters that immigrants sometimes have where people tell them not, don't speak your language, speak English. That's not a nice way to be in the world. And I love the fact that New York City has, we have something like 800 documented languages here. I think that's a fairly beautiful thing. What I do professionally and what I also do a lot of at the grammar table is answer questions about things relating to work. What is the best way to do this in a work, in a professional context, in a work context, or if you're trying to get something published, what is the style that you should follow for this? So I'm not loosey-goosey with it. We communicate in a context, and I would like more people to feel prepared for professional context because we have to make a living, we have to go about our lives and be practical about language. So I would guess about two-thirds of the questions I get asked are connected more with that. How do I do this right for this particular professional context?
Starting sentences with but, because, and so, which people do much more of these days, are you loosey-goosey about that, or is it something you wouldn't do?
I do all of those. The but and the and come up for me more as initial words and sentences in more playful writing. I also used to use it when I was writing journalistically. I didn't go crazy with it. It's not, it's something that I think you have to have. It's a little bit of an art. So you have to have a sense of sentence rhythm in order to do it appropriately. Otherwise, it does start to sound like a mistake. The because thing I'm kind of obsessed with. I would guess that at least 80% of my adult students in my writing classes think that they cannot, that grammatically they're not allowed to begin a sentence with because, and I'm determined to disabuse them of that notion. In fact, I was just speaking about in a class this morning, and I think that one really matters because what a lot of Americans at least do is they'll cross off the because and put due to the fact that, which sounds terrible.
It
So
does.
due to the fact that it is rain, this is exaggeration, but instead of saying because it was raining, I brought an umbrella. Due to the fact that it was raining, I brought an umbrella, and it's so unnatural. I actually got criticism after one of my interviews for the way I pronounce a certain word, and I'd like to share that with you if you wouldn't mind. That word is the word the.
Before a vowel, before.
Before a vowel, right? So the orange rather than the orange. I don't really know exactly what I do because I don't spend time thinking about my pronunciation of the, but in the interview I said the in front of a vowel.
That's a demographic trend, isn't it? Young New Zealanders all say the before an E, but when you say, it is the East and Juliet is the sun, it doesn't sound right, does it?
You know what? I just don't even notice. As long as there's a the sound in there, I think it all just blends together for me.
We all have our pet hates, and the one that makes, well, one of the ones that makes me mad is, prevaricate instead of procrastinate, which is so common now. Is there anything?
What? That's common?
Yeah,
You
very much so.
that's pretty fancy for a mistake. I have never heard that. I don't hear the word prevaricate very often, but I think I would be pretty excited if I got to hear such a fancy mistake.
What are the mistakes that you really don't like, despite your relaxed attitude?
I really have achieved a state of language equanimity, I think. There are really few things that bother me anymore. I used to be bothered more at a certain point.
What about misspelling the word responsibility on the Australian $50 note, not once but three times?
Well, at least it was thorough. No, so that's a really bad error. It does seem perhaps that there wasn't enough of a process with multiple people, though. Has there been any reporting on how many people actually looked at it and approved it?
It was sent to the printers correctly spelled, and the mishap happened within the printing firm which is said to be quote mortified unquote. There is something I want to ask you, which is important, and that's whether we use enough words. Is our language just becoming impoverished, you know, when everything is either inappropriate or unacceptable, instead of a thousand other synonyms that are colourful and could be used?
I think at any point in the past century and way before that, you're always going to find some people who use a lot of words with lots of nuance and variety, and then some people who rely on a smaller collection of active vocabulary. What I think bothers me more is when people try to get fancy when they don't have good control over the words they're using. The example that you mentioned a little while ago with the prevaricate and procrastinate would be an example of that. So I'm interested in authenticity. I've seen a lot of email. We communicate so much in writing now in a way that we didn't a generation ago. So every, you know, all these things that would have happened orally, we now have in writing through email or text. I find that a lot of people get stuck when they're trying to put what would have been an oral communication into writing. They sound like someone else. They get overly fancy and overly complicated. You have the other end of the spectrum too, where people are too casual. But I'm especially interested where people who just want to ask a simple question will double the word count and grow the word length to make it sound really official. And it's kind of distancing. It puts space between people instead of bringing them together.
Doubling the word count. That's dead right.
That might be an underestimate. You know, if we really counted, it might be triple. But anyway, that kind of thing happens a lot.
Tripling the word count and adding jargon. That's my...
That's right. Exactly.
Lovely to talk to you. So can you just tell us before we finish, we could talk to you all day, I think, but we mustn't. So what is the reason for you going across the United States with your grammar table?
The reason is the same reason that I guess I went out originally, that it seems like an enjoyable thing to do. But I also, that's the short answer. The longer answer is that I actually am going to be writing a book about this, and my husband is going to shoot a documentary about it. It's just been a really, in a time of a lot of anger and hostility, it's been something I think that I, at least for me, I can vouch for me personally, it's been something that makes me laugh and feel happy. And apparently it has had that impact on at least a few other people.
That's reason enough. In fact, that's a great rationale. Is there anything you have not been able to answer and you kick yourself for, just finally, you kick yourself for looking back and you think, I should have known that and I did not?
I can't always answer the question on the spot. I go out with lots of reference books. So I have a little cart, actually, that I roll out. I hold the table in one hand, and I have a cart full of reference books in the other, and then I heap them up on the table. Sometimes people will ask me something that I can't find in my head or in one of the reference books. And while that makes me a little bit sad, it doesn't make me that sad. So I just will say, I'll give them my email address and tell them to follow up if they want to know. Because I think... is it so bad in the world to say, I don't know, every once in a while? I really don't mind, and I don't feel like I have to know everything. I just feel like it's enjoyable to participate in the effort.
Oh, yeah, it is. What an interesting thing you've done, and what interesting results. Alan Jovan, thank you. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you very much, and I appreciated your very detailed question, because that's where I reside, in the details.
Alan Jovan.